Thank you for listening to the Impact Leaders Podcast, featuring leaders focusing on sustainable and impact investment and performance with purpose, sharing their stories, experiences, and advice to increase awareness in the market and highlight best practices in order to help more companies and institutions transition more capital into the industry faster. I'm JP Dalman, founder and CEO of ILM Partners. I am grateful that you're choosing to invest your time in doing this, since I know that you're going to feel encouraged and inspired. Make sure you subscribe to get the notifications from your preferred podcast platform. And do follow us on social media to stay connected. We appreciate your support. It helps keep Impact Leaders going. Enjoy this episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Impact Leaders. I hope everyone is safe and healthy and that you are still managing well during these challenging times. So again, here we are recording a new episode for you. And in today's episode of Impact Leaders, we have Jason Mitchell as our guest. Hi, Jason.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Welcome, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for the invitation. I'm really pleased to be speaking about this on your platform.
Thank you. It's a real honor to have you. I know also a special thanks because I know that last night you were up in the middle of the night still working and preparing for a webinar with some of your Australian clients. So I thought I'd just highlight, what a hardworking individual you are.
And, thanks. And a shout out to what can be gained from energy drinks like Monster.
Perfect. So I hope you are feeling okay today. I think you are in the UK, right?
Yes, I am.
Perfect. So we are back in the UK today and I'm still enjoying, I was going to say sunny Kent, but it's not very sunny today. Actually, we had thunderstorm, which is unusual. So allow me to briefly try to introduce you to our guests. So Jason Mitchell is co-head of responsible investment for Man Group PLC. He is responsible for directing the development of impact thematic and norms-based investment strategies, as well as the broader integration of ESG criteria across asset classes and multi-asset solutions. Jason also acts as an advisor on funds where ESG, impact investing, engagement, and norms-based screening represent a principal feature of the strategy. He co-chairs Man Group's Stewardship and Active Ownership Committee. He speaks and writes widely on social and environmental issues, most recently in the FT and London Review of Book. He's also a fellow host of an award-winning podcast, A Sustainable Future, focusing on what we're doing today to build a more sustainable world tomorrow. And there's so much more I can talk about your contribution to the industry, Jason, but I did not want to have people listen to me talking about the initiatives you are a member of and support at the beginning, but we'll try to cover it during the episode. And I also will put a link to your bio as part of the episode so people can check it out.
Great.
I cannot stress enough, there's so much that you are doing that I'm sometimes beyond impressed how humans can do so much. But yes, thank you for that. So as it is our tradition, we ask first question to all our guests, which is, what is sustainable and impact investing? But perhaps in view of your role, we should add the extra question, which is, what is responsible investing?
Yeah, it's a great way to start off because there's so many different takes on this. My definition has changed over time. When I first began in this space, it was outside the investment world. I'd taken 2 years out in 2008, 2009, and early 2010 to advise on a water company, on a company called the African Development Corporation, so a private equity company, as well as advise with the UK government at a place called the Commonwealth Business Council. And at that time, so I was sort of, it took me to sub-Saharan Africa to present national governments at the subnational level in countries like Nigeria, Ghana, South Africa, Rwanda as well in East Africa. And it was sort of fascinating because, over that period, and I was specifically focused in on agricultural and water projects, specifically water, urban and peri-urban water projects. And I guess, that experience and time sort of made me really sort of appreciate and sort of come up with my own definition about a decade ago, which was sustainability is the investment required to address demographic, social, and environmental change. And it was a very materialistic or material-oriented. It was very, I guess, Marxian, you would say, in terms of having this sort of these material needs met. It wasn't so much on the normative side. And following that experience, when I returned and began from 2010 for the better part of a decade, managing a number of funds, including on a global sustainability fund, I think that definition grew to sort of encompass best managed, best governed, sort of the non-material kind of effects of it around good governance, around ethics, in terms of exclusions, in terms of what labor rights or human rights, how it can be integrated into it. So it's really sort of changed over the last decade in a very good sense, I think.
See, that's it. It's very interesting because I was going at one point ask you about this period where you went and did some of this work. So it's interesting to see that that was effectively kind of a pivotal point for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, you know, I sort of look back at my own arc and I love understanding people's arcs, particularly when they enter into this space. But, you know, I've had two big pivotal kind of points in my arc. I mean, the first was that 2008 to 2010 experience that really sort of drove me into kind of understanding what the requirements are for managing growth. You know, think about managing, you know, a city like Lagos, for instance, where I did a number of work projects, and the requirements for managing, you know, at one point that city was growing its population by 2.5% per annum. I mean, pretty significant. So how do you manage for that growth in the context of healthcare, in terms of education, in terms of green infrastructure and water and waste, agriculture, food? So there was that point. And then the second point that really furthered my appreciation for it was at the end of 2015. And by that time, you know, I'd had a lot of experience managing a number of an environmental fund, a global sustainability sort of thematic fund. But, you know, I'd gone to a number of the COPs, including, you know, the Paris COP. But at the end of 2015, right after the Paris COP, you know, I found myself with some friends in Calais during the European migrant crisis. And to me, that just boggled my mind. I mean, the fact that, you know, you're 300 miles away from Paris or London, and you're finding this humanitarian crisis. And at that point, there was a real reluctance by governments to allow in the International Red Cross or MSF. And so that kind of expanded this idea of what this meant beyond the climate or environmental dimension into very much the social dimension, which has sort of taken me on a number of other paths, both investment and non-investment related.
Yes. And you touched on a couple of points there that, you know, again, I had no thought about, we may be talking about, but the point, for example, of Lagos. So the migration crisis and Calais is very close to home. And I think most people, at least in the UK, may have had a bit of an experience. I definitely saw it on the news. But what people may not see on the news is that only, I can't remember the exact percentage, but I'm pretty sure it was less than 10% of the people in Lagos have access to water and sewage. I saw a documentary on that very recently, and it's actually shocking. So it's a very good way to start. And then so all of these basically brings you to this concept that, you know, responsible investing, you know, is about meeting a kind of these material needs, and therefore there's that link to a kind of sustainability and impact, right?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, I would say it began as, you know, sort of Marx always thought that certain material conditions had to be met, you know, food or jobs, you know, and from then on you find these sort of epiphenomenal effects, you know, sort of, you know, how people act or what they believe in, you know, sort of not these non-material facts. And I guess over time, though, what's been really fascinating to me, particularly over the last several years, is how those don't seem so distinct anymore in terms of, you know, value and values when it comes to investing approaches, how there's much more research, particularly academic research or even practitioner research, much more, I guess, a sort of experience conflating, but in a good way, those dimensions.
I think what I wanted to talk about a little bit, and we will come back to some of these points later in the episode, but just a little bit of context around Man Group and the work that you're doing there. So I want to just tell people a little bit about my group in case they don't know about it.
Sure.
And also, yeah. I was just going to read a little bit of a bio about the group, because there's a couple of points there which I thought were very interesting. So if you allow me, I'll say that my group, PLC, is an active investment management firm. Interesting enough, initially it was founded as a sugar corporate and brokerage by James Mann in 1783. And it provides a range of funds for institutional and private investors globally. And it's the world's largest publicly traded hedge fund company, supporting around $117 billion in funds under management as of December 2019. And I may quote some other numbers that are more recent. You are headquartered in Riverbank House in London, and you employ about 1,000 people in various locations globally. Your focus on delivering kind of attractive performance and client portfolio solutions, kind of deploying latest technologies across your business to, you know, help ensure that you stay at the forefront of the evolving industry. Obviously, you cover long-only private markets, single and multi-manager bases. You have a wide range of products. And then I picked up that, you know, I think 84% of the group funds under management are institutional investors. So how does, and I can see also responsible investment is, you know, a big part of what you are doing as a firm. And we can talk obviously about the business and the part, different parts of the business. But what can you tell us a little bit more about Man Group and then again, your efforts across responsible investment?
So I've been at Man or parts of Man for a very long time. It feels like since 2004, with the exception of 2 years where I worked for, as I've mentioned, the UK government from 08 to 2010. But I came up within the part of Man called GLG Partners. It's the discretionary business. So my background is on the alternative, i.e. long short side, managing the strategies there, particularly in global telecoms and media. And so that happened sort of way back in time up until effectively 2008. Man Group has since then made a number of acquisitions. One was GLG Partners. Another one was Numeric, our Boston-based, one of our systematic businesses that's Boston-based, among others. And so it's an interesting organization, you know, kind of coming up from the GLG side. You know, I've always tended to think of responsible investment, of ESG, through the lens of an active discretionary manager, be it both long short or long only. And what that meant, which was typically a bottom up fundamental kind of old school type of analysis, mm-hmm. you know, driven by company engagements, you know, meetings, building your own models. But very, very fundamental. And it wasn't so much on the, you know, kind of top-down systematic side. I think what's fascinating, having been at Man for this time and gradually sort of changing my roles. So I have been a portfolio manager up until mid-2018, you know, and until that time, effectively wearing, you know, a couple different hats. One is a portfolio manager and another is as Man Group sustainability strategist. But in mid-2018, I transitioned to a dedicated role that I am in now as co-head of responsible investment. So I no longer manage funds, although I do advise on a number of strategies where ESG, stewardship, impact, you know, are a key feature within those strategies. But it's been fascinating because the way I tend to frame Man for people who are unfamiliar, Man is think of it as sort of in effect, a holding company with five different types of businesses. So there's the discretionary business called GLG that I mentioned. There's the private markets business. There is a fund of funds business. And there are two very, very different quant or systematic businesses. One called Numeric is more sort of the typical equities and fixed income oriented systematic business. The other called AHL is more to do with sort of CTA managed futures. So think of all the securities outside of the equities and fixed income universe. And for a long time, that collection of businesses, it was hard for me to sort of reconcile what that represented in the context of responsible investment or sustainability, because they were so different and each one had its, particularly some had their own challenges when it came to how you integrate ESG. And so what I tell people is that there is absolutely a unifying approach when it comes to responsible investment across the firm. And by that, I mean, you know, frameworks, a policy framework, not just at the Man level, but at each underlying business. a stewardship framework that's very centralized, an educational framework, an organizational framework, of which I'm part of, and a research and analytics platform that is centralized. But when it comes to specific approaches about how you integrate, you know, environmental, social, and governance, i.e. ESG or impact, there is no unified approach. And frankly, we don't want that. In fact, we actually think that cultivating different types of approaches is actually a huge positive for us. Because when you think about all these businesses, think about them as individual streets or lanes all meeting at one intersection that it, you know, kind of feels like Piccadilly Square. It's just noisy, loud. And at that intersection, when it comes to the space, you find differing, sometimes conflicting expectations, approaches, and implementations of, let's say, ESG. You know, so for instance, is ESG, you know, is it, as we've always known over the last couple of decades, is it bottom up fundamental kind of analysis in terms of meeting companies, understanding these risks on a security by security basis? Or from a quant perspective, is it a top down factor? Can it be quantified? Can you look at indices, markets, or sort of groups of stock or issuers and understand or sort of identify in the same way that you would with growth or momentum, or quality or size, what ESG is, or sustainability or good governance? On the fund to fund side, how would you implement all of those learnings into manager selection and manager assessment? And how would you carry that over to private markets as well, where that information is not as abundant or transparent? And so I guess my point is that intersection has just been incredibly powerful for, first of all, kind of understanding what we want to build. Secondly, and probably most importantly, what are we solving for? I.e., what's the end game? Yes. You know, whereas a few years ago, and I think this is true with most managers when they look at this space, I mean, particularly now when you see the asset flows into this area, particularly on the ETF side and other managers launching a lot of product. Are you solving for product innovation? And that has to be, you know, is a commercial reality, some part of the end game. But is that the only end game? Because the bigger end game, as we've always talked about, is how do you understand this kind of risk better? You know, how do you start to help clients allocate capital and identify in the context of everything we already know about other different types of risks? How do you sort of elevate this kind of risk up from case studies that typically examine this kind of risk at a single issuer or single security level? How do you elevate that up to the portfolio level? How do you elevate it up to an allocator's assessment of managers? So how can you allocate to managers better? And ultimately, how can you start to elevate this up to asset allocation strategies, of which there are very few that really, you know, in a rigorous way, embed this kind of risk?
Yes. And I want to come back to the last point when we talked a little bit about some of the clients, some of the work that you have done. But then before we move on, you mentioned basically, I think, all of your businesses. So Man AHL, Man Numeric, which is covering quantitative, the discretionary, which is Man GLG and Man FRM. And then you have private markets as well, which is Man GPM, right? And then, so you mentioned about, if I understood it, so I like the analogy of the Piccadilly Circus kind of roundabout. So you have all the companies, you have effectively this guidance, and so you have the, if I look at your website as well, so it's, you have your approach, which is these 3 points, the stewardship, the ESG factors, the activities and education. Then you have these capabilities, which is your responsible investment framework, looking at these kind of base standard, RI integrated, RI dedicated, and you have this ESG analytical tools, which has some key features. So this is kind of for everyone to have some kind of guidance, and for clients also to be able to use it, I'm assuming, on the ESG analytics tools. But then kind of each firm within the group and each fund can apply their own kind of stamp and parts of ESG and sustainable investing to themselves. Is that correct?
Yeah. We have some strategies that take all the work that we've done over the last couple of years in terms of trying to isolate ESG, this ESG model. And that's a separate conversation if you're interested, but absolutely fascinating. what we've learned out of that. But, you know, from a quant or a systematic perspective, using that kind of data set is pretty uncontroversial. You know, you might include it within your multi-factor, maybe a five-factor model. So you've got quality, we've got something called informed investor, value, and maybe some, you know, another factor, maybe momentum. And then you also include ESG. So it's one of five factors, and it's not an overlay. It's not a tilt. This thing is, you know, it's part of the algorithm that's trying to find the best companies out there that profile well across all those factors. You might use that data if you're a quant, for instance, to help clients create a product that defines an upper and a lower bound, i.e. it's kind of constraint oriented. Those typically tend to be around environmental criteria. So for instance, if you want to kind of create a fund that targets a certain level or tolerance for carbon emissions across sectors, you know, you can do that fairly easily from a quantitative perspective and sort of solve for a certain kind of tracking error. You can probably less easily do that on a ratings, you know, using ordinal, you know, ratings, but still you can do that as well. I think what is sort of interesting is it's very easy to kind of get seduced by the data element, but when you try and sort of take all that work and bring it back to your fundamental bottom up, but let's say long only investor that, you know, where that represented by GLG Partners, of which I was part of or came up through, you know, those portfolio managers, they don't want to be driven by a model or a factor, right? So there's a different kind of use case. And what you have to use for all this empirical work is use it in a way to understand the informational value of non-financial data. So what does it say about longs? You know, in the event that it's an alternative strategy, what does it say, you know, not just on the long side, but on the short side? What does it say about time? You know, when we think about long-term versus short-term, you know, that tends to be a discussion point about investors, you know, horizons or preference around their ownership periods, but it doesn't really say anything about, or it doesn't say much about the materiality, which we often talk about, obviously, which SASB talks about, the materiality of the data. If the data is material, when is it material? I mean, we know it's not milliseconds, it's not seconds or days or weeks or months, but is it 1 year? Is it 2 years? Is it 3 years? And how can we better understand risk to sort of use that temporal dimension? You know, I do want to say that I'm always wary of, and you'll hear me often, you know, sort of stick to this being more risk oriented. I think, you know, and this is, I think this is, I would expect you would find this answer from any other quant, but, you know, quants tend to work with long, long time series, you know, decades, 50 years plus. And so we've got the benefit, you know, in those cases of understanding other factors, of seeing how they behave through different economic cycles. With this kind of data, we don't, you know, we have max one economic cycle, maybe, you know, depending on the data set, not even that. And so if I'm always wary, given that short time series, to sort of talk up the alpha. In fact, I actually think it's probably, you know, a not necessarily a good thing to do.
Interesting. And one question that came to mind is, you know, all this data that you use is a combination of internally produced, externally sourced, or?
Yeah. So we are definitely not in the data collection business. There are some great firms out there that do that already in different types of formats. So I guess within the non-financial data world, I'd sort of distinguish, you've got the, let's call it structured ESG data, you know, by the likes of MSCI or Sustainalytics or other providers that do their kind of sorting and collection and organizational effort and put it into context. And then you've got unstructured data, you know, that might be LinkedIn data, that might be data from transcripts or social media, you name it. So what we tend to focus on is trying to understand, and frankly, we've got the benefit of having a very strong quant competency within Man Group. Two different types. And I say two different types. One type tends to be, you know, more kind of the traditional factor, you know, research and correlation research. And then the other type would be more on the alternative side. You would use tools like NLP, natural language processing, artificial intelligence to some degree, or machine learning. And what we do is work with a number of vendors. We optimize for breadth because our strategies, while we do have some strategies that kind of invest in a 40 stock universe, let's say, we have many others that are have much more breadth because they're systematic. And so we need as big a data feed as possible in terms of breadth, in terms of coverage, regional coverage, asset classes, you name it. And what we focus on is, or what we have focused on for the last 2 to 3 years is working with that data. So understanding first what these statistical idiosyncrasies of these data are, meaning when you go into specific providers of this data, again, the MSCI, Sustainalytics, RepRisks, et cetera, as they collect this data and they aggregate it up to produce scores, what are they doing that's different and that's changing the data or tilting the data? What kind of biases, for instance, are they including within these? And what you often find, and we've spoken about this pretty widely, we have a number of papers about it, is there are, in fact, actually a lot of biases. There's a bias towards larger companies, a transparency bias. There's a bias towards quality as a factor because those tend to be more mature companies. And those two areas tend to be better resourced in terms of policies, disclosures, you know, sort of the box ticking exercises. And as a consequence, they tend to be better rated by firms. The downside of those kinds of approaches is that you potentially penalize smaller companies, you know, companies on the other side of that companies that aren't as well resourced, which isn't to say that these are less well managed or less well governed, but there's sort of a data collection problem on a couple fronts. And so what we do is work with a lot of data. Well, when you don't have long time series of as was data, and by as was, I mean unrevised data. So we're looking for data that is sort of consistent for as far back as possible. And, you know, you can find it typically between 8 to 10 years. There's data set out there. The longest one out there that we're looking at right now that goes back 12 years of unrevised data, which is what we're looking at. But, you know, if you're a quant and you don't have data that goes far back, you know, one approach to work with is you can actually take a lot of different data sets that don't have a long history and start to combine them to create a richer data set. And you can also start to expunge or take out these biases. So how can you sort of retrain or condition the data so that they don't excessively flatter large companies or different regions? So it's more comparable and more uncorrelated. And the idea out of this, and for me, it's fascinating. One of the big innovations, I think, in this space that needs to happen is obviously data oriented, but it's to this point of the two questions I always sort of think to myself that every manager, asset owner, consultant, you name it, needs to think about is when you think about all this data and think about unstructured data, think about structured data, think about standards, think about what you're producing, you should ask yourself first, where do I enter into that? You know, do you just want to buy the top level scores from a certain company and call it a day and kind of design products around that? Or do you want to take that data and further refine it and maybe, you know, condition it from a quant perspective, you know, potentially start to blend it into your own proprietary data that your discretionary managers might be producing or go down that route? And then the second big question is, what's the end game? As you sort of create all that, what do you want to do with it? You know, again, is the end game for someone just to create product or is the bigger end game to kind of help you understand this idea of risk better in the effort to be better at sort of allocating to or away from this kind of risk and build it into models?
Yes, I would say again, fascinating. And it really took a kind of a turn into this data part, which is, you know, the core of everything that is being done inside a business like yours.
Yeah. Well, you know, and one thing that I'd actually like, I'd sort of, I think it's worth mentioning because I don't have a quant background, but I just sort of fascinated with the idea of horizons and particularly in a data context. I think you get those acronyms like AI, ML, machine learning, and NLP that are very sort of buzzwords, you know, within the ESG space. I think we intentionally did not start with that, but rather we've been working with a lot of data to try and derive something different, you know, this sort of orthogonal kind of uncorrelated factor around ESG. I think What's interesting when you look at these two approaches, you know, and when AI or NLP or machine learning comes in, I mean, those are very unique because when you think about sort of time horizons and when you think about the near term versus the long term. So why would you use AI, NLP or machine learning? You would use them when you have so much data that you can't really intuit anything out of it. You can't really divine anything out of it. So for instance, think about all the social media kind of postings or inferences around a certain product or a certain company. You know, how would you understand what that would mean in terms of a sentiment indicator? You know, one powerful way to do it is to use, you know, machine learning or NLP to do that. But when you're doing that, you're examining very, very short-term data. Again, social media data. And so, you know, there's a definite use for this. It's incredibly interesting, but you're talking about something that you divine, it call it a signal that decays fairly quickly. Now, as you start to go further and further out, even from a quant perspective, you know, 12 months, 2 years, 3 years, it becomes almost in a sense a little bit easier. Not to say that the data is easier to find, but the kind of model you're using it within becomes easier because it has to be economically intuitive, right? On a 3 to 4 or 5 year basis. I mean, we might all have different nuanced opinions about what a sustainable company actually means. But I think, you know, despite all the nuances, we're not that far off in terms of what good governance represents or sort of low emissions, et cetera, right? So it becomes, as you start to think and work with this data on a longer and longer term basis, it should become more and more intuitive versus, you know, kind of looking at different kinds of data on a short-term basis becoming less and less intuitive, which requires different kinds of data tools.
Very, very interesting. And so we went down to the kind of bottom level of the information that you use. And again, to circle back to what you were talking about, so each one of your fund managers is effectively looking at all this information that you have available. In terms of, I was thinking as you were speaking, in terms of kind of reports that you put out there, you don't effectively measure or identify or measure impact as such or responsible investment, right? So it's just within everything that you do.
Yeah, I mean, on the impact side, I would say a fairly new area for Man Group to become involved with. I tend to kind of carry a more, I guess, old school orthodox definition of what impact is. So when I think of impact, you know, my definition begins with intentionality. And, you know, I think because there are certain challenges as you sort of introduce impact in other asset classes, particularly on the listed side, I think impact has become, it's had to balance between intentionality and measurability. And so often what you find is, and it is great work, there are just more challenges in terms of trying to measure your impact. But when I think of my sort of orthodox definition, I tend to think of intentionality. I tend to think of certainly to some degree subordinating returns for the socioeconomic returns. And so we do have one strategy, this UK community housing strategy, which is absolutely about, you know, intentionality. It doesn't over earn. It's aimed for asset owners who were specifically looking for that socioeconomic improvement in terms of communities and providing low cost housing for those kinds of communities.
We should do another episode perhaps with that team in the future.
Yeah, it's a fantastic area. And so when you think about measurement there, I think it's a much easier, kind of very clear story that you can run on. So I mean, that is sort of driven by Gene standards, also by Big Society Capital, outcomes matrix. You know, there's a very, very rigorous, as well as GRI sort of framework for understanding and reporting the metrics on that. I mean, down to very consistent surveys to tenants as well to kind of understand satisfaction. So that I think is just, it's incredible. And I'd love to see more of that, not just within Man, but in the entire space. We've got some other strategies that talk to impact, you know, but again, these are in the listed form. So it's a bit different. You know, you have, you know, I would say impactful ownership, particularly, you know, when it comes to very powerful shareholder resolutions. like, you know, most recently the Barclays Resolution 2930, which we supported. You've had some others as well that were credible precedents coming into this year. The Mizuho in Japan climate resolution was among those. And then there are some other listed strategies that speak to the SDGs. I would not say that they identify as SDG funds, but certainly describe exposures and returns, I would say, you know, against an SDG framework. Those aren't all of our funds, but those are some.
Good. I could keep talking to you about this area for, I think, the rest of the episode, but I just want to make sure that we cover a couple more things before we run out of time. So I wanted to just touch on all of these points that you mentioned on your clients, you know, and the type of clients that come to you, given everything that you're offering, and maybe touch more specifically on this kind of pull-push relationship that sometimes is mentioned out there in the news between kind of asset owners and fund managers, and the creation and the need for products and the non-existence of them in some cases. And I think you mentioned before that ultimately it's about what are we solving for, and about, you know, managing that risk in the horizon. And obviously, you know, clients have a risk profile that they're trying to solve for. Maybe you can share a little bit of, you know, what are the type of conversations that you are having, or that, or type of requests that you are hearing from asset owners. That would be sure. Nice.
Yeah, I mean, it is fascinating. I mean, having been in this area for the last now 12 years, I just have seen it's been a complete sea change over the last 12 to 24 months, a complete sea change, you know, reflected in RFPs, requests for proposals, where clients are asking for information in a way that they haven't before. You know, it's clearly not a box ticking exercise. Seeing markets move, you know, for a long time, I had a number of slides in my presentation, and it was just to sort of portray what responsible investment assets looked like in certain markets. And it was an attempt not to use just the GSIA or PRI figures, which critics would say tend to overstate it, but simply it looks at the top 50 asset owners. So it doesn't count, double count AUM, but it looks at the top 50 asset owners among some specific markets. It uses Preqin data, and we spent a lot of time understanding which of those asset owners have a strong preference for responsible investment, which admittedly, it could mean a lot of different things. It could mean an interest in impact. It could mean an interest in an enhanced exclusion list or ESG, in whether it be discretionary or quant. But the point is, it's an active interest in this area and an expectation to see either product or certain features integrated. And it was fascinating because when you start looking at these markets, so we looked at four, Canada, Australia, Europe, and the US. And the last survey we did was about 2 years ago. We're currently revamping this right now. And you know, what you found was around 70% of European asset owners had a strong interest in this, not surprisingly. When you looked at Australia, it was around 45 to 50%. Canada was around 60%, surprisingly, because of some of the regulatory and statutory obligations within Ontario. And the US, by our estimates, was around 16 to 17%. So, I mean, fairly, fairly small. And it was just, you could take a few messages away from this. I mean, first, there was a clear leadership effect in many of these markets. What you found is some of the biggest pension funds kind of pushing this agenda forward, either from a normative perspective or regulatory perspective. And what that did was really influence the rest of the tail of that top 50. So you found the tail kind of following along. You know, you found three of these markets, with the exception of the US, all at different rates, but certainly sort of move forward. Even outside of this, you can make the argument that markets like Japan or South Korea, I mean, most recently Singapore, are advancing as well. But it also brought up some really fascinating points about why the US was such an anomaly, at least back then. You know, and two of the popular arguments were, number one for big U.S. pension funds. You found that officials were elected. And so, you know, I guess the theory is that they play the electoral cycle, i.e. the short term versus the long term, which ESG is more about. But I think more interestingly, you found that the funding ratios for pension funds varied dramatically. So in all four areas outside of the U.S., you found fairly healthy funding ratios between 80 to 100%. In some cases, you found, you know, many pension funds overfunded as a result of the global financial crisis. There was just a better management. In the U.S., you found that 66%, it was a 66% funding ratio. So there was a huge hole in that funding ratio. And I guess the argument would be that, is that influencing how U.S. pension funds are sort of thinking about ESG or responsible investment? You know, does that hole push them out on the risk curve a little bit more? Does it narrow their definition of fiduciary duty to something that is almost purely financial because they're frankly just trying to make returns up and they don't have the allowance or the buffer to kind of think about longer term issues? But the point is that, you know, from doing that work and characterizing these markets 2 years ago, you know, as we're compiling this work now, you know, even markets like the US are seeing, you know, a noticeable change in terms of expectations around this area for a number of different reasons that, you know, I don't think we have time to go into.
Yes. But you know, it's extremely fascinating. I will try to dig out that report if it is available and then look forward to say reading about your findings on the next version. You know, I coincidentally, as I mentioned to you offline, I just recently published an article on Forbes.com entitled Sustainable Investment and the Race to Zero Emissions During the COVID-19 Pandemic as a way to capture the attention. But really what I was covering there was a lot of these points that you mentioned around kind of the investors. I'm assuming it's going to come out also of your next report. So investors deploying capital kind of with purpose, I say, but basically, you know, how they are incorporating ESG factors into their investment processes. And there was a recent report from Morgan Stanley where they surveyed also about 110 public and private investors, and kind of 78% of them but agree that sustainable investing is a risk mitigation strategy, but they didn't go into the split that you have, which would be very interesting to look into. And then I was going to say, it's interesting to see this, you know, sea change that you mentioned, because you have been a manager yourself and you have these conversations. And I picked up in one of the things that you did. So you launched the MAN GLG Global Sustainability Fund, you know, maybe about over 5 years ago, and you were managing the Virgin Climate Change Fund. And now we have, you know, all of this that is happening around really climate change and climate crisis. Really driving, you know, at least the news. But then I was just going to go around the loop again and ask you, how much is that on the interest of the investors right now? How much is climate change, climate action, climate crisis in their vocabulary and their decision making?
Yeah, I would say a huge, huge amount. You know, in a way that it's sort of hard to quantify, but I don't think I've ever been busier across different markets and different types of markets within markets in my life, and particularly having some of the most fascinating conversations around, again, what are you solving for? You know, is it just product oriented, or is it about being a better allocator to different types of risks? You know, that's one area that is probably worth mentioning. But like, you know, sort of when I came up through this as a discretionary manager, to me, what was sort of an interesting question, but, you know, many years ago, very hard to vocalize was, you know, if you were to manage an ESG fund or a fund that where ESG was the defining feature for it, if you were an allocator on the other side of the table from that fund manager, how well could they answer the question, okay, well, so you've got an ESG fund, how much is ESG driving your returns? You know, in that conversation, what you would typically get is an answer very different from every other part of finance. So, for instance, if you were an allocator and I managed a fund that happened to invest in Japan focused on large cap value, we would meet several times a year and we would talk about sort of my performance, you know, and process. And I would speak in the general framing of Japan, large cap, and value. if you came in, and beyond that, we talk about stock attribution and, you know, stories or process. If you came in one day and met with me and found that my strategy suddenly invested in a lot of US small cap growth, there would be a problem, right? That's not what you allocated to. That's not the kind of risk that you allocated to. And so, that's a helpful framing. The question is, how can you actually have that kind of constructive dialogue in the ESG space? Because typically, if you ask that question to a manager, what you will get is that manager going to their process slide and telling you kind of, look, this is my process, you know, and I'm using these kinds of data sources and I'm engaging with companies. It's this iterative process. But that doesn't really answer the question that you're asking, right? If you, as an allocator, ask for more evidence, what they typically will tend to do is take you to the appendix and show you three or four case study slides. Look, that's fine. I mean, case studies are incredibly powerful. You know, I mean, they're a narrative. The problem is you as an allocator are trying to understand performance attribution and risk exposure at a portfolio level. What you have been given are three or four examples, which constitute probably 15, 20, 25% of the portfolio, probably not more than that. They have been cherry picked and they describe anecdotes. They're not attribution, right? And they are fundamentally different. You know, I sort of make this joke that I've maybe the audience is sort of, or listeners have kind of heard this, but I sort of liken it to this story that I've heard before, which is, did you know in 1929, Charlie Chaplin entered a Charlie Chaplin lookalike contest? Have you ever heard of this?
No,
he did. So in 1929, Charlie Chaplin entered a Charlie Chaplin lookalike contest. And the story goes, he came in third or worse than that, which is fascinating. The reason I'm saying that is that's a fantastic anecdote. It's a powerful story. It survived almost 100 years, right? But when you look into what that story says, you know, there it becomes more problematic, right? It doesn't say or reveal anything about his filmography and sort of particularly his political work during sort of the pre-war years. It doesn't tell us who came in first or second, right? So it's sort of an empty anecdote that is funny. It survives. It's great to tell to a crowd of people to get some laughs, but it doesn't reveal context. Right? And I think what we're trying to do at a certain point, and I don't want to sound too quanty because all this work is no substitution for stewardship and engagement and the other side of ESG, but I think we just need to pursue an effort to be better at identifying this risk. You know, the Porter, you know, old anecdote of what's measurable is manageable. I'm a firm believer in that. If you can't measure, how can you manage this? You know, and this is probably why in our space, you know, sort of when we talk about ESG, it's more of a rhetorical device. We talk about mitigation, you know, et cetera, versus how we treat risk in quantitative finance, you know, in the evolution of finance, you know, in terms of the capital asset pricing model or three-factor models or five-factor, you know, Fama French models. You know, that's, I think I'd done a podcast once and I think Bob Litterman had sort of said it, you know, very clearly, you know, ESG, you know, ratings, scores, that's not risk. Risk is a number, you know, it's value at risk, it's volatility, right? And we can actually use that to understand stability of markets, you know, that regulators often worry about. We can think about, you sort of leverage that to figure out how to put into context climate risk, which is systemic clearly, and it's starting to feel more and more systematic given the regularity of these issues. By doing that, that we're going to be able to sort of, in a much better constructive way, start to include this in global asset allocation models.
Excellent. And it's interesting because you did mention stewardship and engagement, which is something that you are focusing on, you know, quite a lot during the work that you're doing. But I'm also conscious of the time that we have. I was thinking about talking about the future and relating to everything we've been talking just now and how we can assess this risk, right? And come up with this number. And I know that you participate in many committees, you know, internally and externally, including, you know, the UNPRI, just to name one. Mm-hmm. And you speak with so many great leaders, you know, across, and then also, you know, through the podcast. But I thought, is there any, on the long-term kind of macroeconomics risks, you know, such as this slow global growth or now, you know, minus the low interest rates, you know, these emerging societal and technological trends. How is this affecting and will affect, you know, if there is one perhaps that you want to pick or a couple to responsible investing and perhaps even your work around stewardship and engagement, since we haven't spoke about that?
Yeah, you know, I can think of some works on the climate side in terms of long-term risks. I'm a big fan of, you know, TCFD in terms of, you know, scenario analysis. I think one of the interesting things when you look at this kind of scenario analysis, you know, one of the issues that we sort of grapple with is we're all talking scenario analysis, you know, TCFD is incredibly buzzy, but the Trucost has mentioned in the past that out of the, I think, 15,000 companies that they monitor, only 10% of them provide enough forward projections to do scenario analysis. And most companies tend to sort of build out these forecasts on a typical, you know, business cycle, i.e. 3 to 5 years. And when you think about the kind of climate risk, you know, when you think about the kind of horizon that describes climate risk, I mean, we're thinking 10, 20, 30 at minimum, but certainly longer than 3 to 5 years. I think this is an area that is dying out for more and more work. You know, I've been involved in some committees and we've not, I think, gotten to a point to produce something, but I'd love to see more. I mean, one of the things, this is not so much on the macro, you know, economic side, which is sort of problematic. I would, you know, as a footnote, just given everything that you're trading in those kinds of strategies, you know, whether it's, you know, kind of futures, the interest rate swaps, you know, et cetera, like how do you can make some tenuous linkages to sovereign ratings or, you know, to different types of instruments, but, you know, they are tenuous and kind of harder. So I think we've not gotten to a point where there's a real credible kind of linkage to, you know, ESG and sort of a macroeconomic long-term understanding of what this stuff represents broadly across ESG. There obviously has been some good work around climate. The one thing I would highlight though is, you know, and kudos to you for doing this podcast. It's just education. One of the best things that I've done is produce a chapter for the edition 2 of the CFA's ESG investing certificate. It's chapter 8 on portfolio construction and management, where, you know, our good friend Ben Yeo is also doing another one of the chapters. But it is just, it's been such a process of sort of understanding, you know, what's out there and what's lacking and what is sort of in play in terms of people kind of focused and doing work in these areas. You know, these podcasts are going to be, you know, in some small way, a huge help as well. My gripe has always been that as an industry, I mean, finance, we've done a great job in terms of educating our clients, but we've done a poor job in terms of kind of playing the longer game and just more broadly educating in a way that where we're not simply, you know, kind of pandering or you know, marketing our products or our portfolio managers or our strategists, where we're, you know, sort of talking about these issues, the challenges, and bringing on great people to discuss.
Yes. And on that point, and this is one of the reasons, you know, why I do this, and thank you for the comment, you know, given everything that is happening and the evolution as well of society, you know, on the short term because of all the events. But is there any kind of opportunity that you can see in terms of, you know, how we can help transition more capital, you know, into being more responsible in the way they invest?
I do think that we've actually got to be a lot smarter now in terms of product innovation. So I've really come around to that. And I don't mean simply another, you know, kind of 30, 40 or 50 stock, you know, discretionary portfolio. There will always be sort of a market somewhere for that. But I mean, how do we thrust the responsible investment agenda across different asset classes? You know, kudos to the Financial Reporting Council, the FRC, for really making a push or a go at this in the new UK Stewardship Code 2020, where they basically take, you know, the notion of stewardship and really kind of thrust it beyond just equities to, you know, into the real assets world and fixed income. But in the same way, because there is such a large percentage of global investment assets in the non equities and fixed income space. And that might be, you know, sort of futures, currencies, commodities, you name it. Mm. How can we be better at, first of all, understanding the risks specific to those, these different asset classes, and helping, because you would be surprised, or maybe you wouldn't, just in terms of particularly the institutional money and sort of pension funds that have big assets in these portfolios just to manage their volatility or risk. But how can we thrust, you know, this kind of analysis into those areas? And then I think there's an argument where you can do it from an ESG perspective, but there's definitely an argument when it comes to a values perspective, i.e., you know, exclusions. You know, I was one of the architects of putting together one of MAN RI responsible investment exclusion list. Yes. Together. I'm actually a believer. I'm pretty pragmatic in terms of the fact that, you know, you can organize this area in terms of universal conduct related and idiosyncratic exclusions. And within those universal areas, you find areas that are norms, are conventions being UN conventions or World Health Organization or the Paris Agreement, you know, that are supported by kind of call it a global consensus. You know, and one other interesting way is simply to look at all the asset owners, and you can find this through public information. And we've also sort of leveraged the mandates that we use to put some non-public, you know, element within that to sort of understand, you know, the sheer amount of pension fund assets that are implementing all or some degree of those universal assets. And it is significant and it continues to grow.
Excellent. And I can see, again, without, you know, going into too much again, specifically to the stewardship part, but that is where you can make the difference, right? By having, you know, the conversations to look at the values of the investors and understand them, especially kind of new clients that you can attract mm-hmm. to the firm. Mm-hmm. As we're coming towards the last questions, you know, I have this section where I talk a little bit more about you, but it's been very nice because we have covered quite a little bit about how you kind of evolved to becoming, you know, the specialist that you are, the different kind of pivoting, you know, points, you know, the part that you, in 2008 and 10, that you were advising the government and you were working across Sub-Saharan Africa. So it's been really, really nice, you know, to learn more about you, Jason, as a person, as a man, as a professional. But I just wanted to kind of just check a couple more things, just ask you maybe around kind of something perhaps deeper around what drives you, or if there are, you know, there's somebody, you know, or something that inspire you or inspires you every day that you can share with us.
There's not one thing. There's definitely a handful of experiences that I've had, you know, and I find these themes through these experiences kind of continue to sort of reappear. So, I mean, when I mentioned sort of working in Calais at the end of 2015 in the migrant camp, that was for about 2 weeks at the end of Christmas. I mean, that sort of drove me towards taking a number of months off during 2016 and going to Lesbos and working with a group that works with the Medicine Sans Frontières, the Doctors Without Borders in northern Lesbos, and literally sort of spend nights in the cold on the coast of northern Lesbos watching for refugee rafts crossing in from Turkey. You know, after that, it was going to the border of Greece and Turkey in terms of handing out life jackets or trying to sort of help with some of the support networks for fleeing migrants. And then ultimately that led later that year to working with a couple NGOs, German NGOs, on particularly harrowing experience for me, but it was the smallest refugee NGO rescue boat off the coast of Libya. And so it was a retired German Coast Guard boat that was 26 meters in size. And we were working with a number of NGOs off, you know, call it 20 miles off the Libyan coast. During that period, you know, we were there when there was just an exodus over the number of weeks I worked there of, you know, a couple thousand migrants and refugees leaving the Libyan coast. And I write about this in article it's probably the best thing, the proudest thing that I've written in the London Review of Books, if anyone's interested, but it's sort of a true experience. But I guess when I keep coming out of this, you know, part of that experience was, you know, effectively off the, you know, 20 miles off the coast of Libya, having to put bodies in body bags. So, you know, in the middle of the Mediterranean, refugees that had drowned, you know, and finding that sort of in this such a remote spot, there's literally no one else there besides a few other NGO boats. And so these themes sort of started to emerge at that time. And one is dignity, you know, and sort of the dignity that sort of drove people to leave, you know, make this, you know, treacherous escape, you know, and ultimately the dignity of them, you know, sort of dying in this kind of way, you know, in the middle of the Mediterranean. I think what was sort of interesting was hearing Mary Robinson, the last episode that of my own podcast, A Sustainable Future. Yeah. And she brings up, you know, dignity, you know, within human rights being a really, really important commonality, you know, and it's recognizing this idea of dignity that makes us help, makes us all want to work at solving global problems, you know, because they're global, because they need global solutions like climate change or the pandemic most recently. And so, I mean, that's one, but if anyone's interested, it's not a long read, but it's a fantastic, very powerful essay about a true story.
Thank you. And I'm glad you mentioned that episode because it does touch in, I mean, all the episodes. I was going to mention these just now, you know, the podcast. It's something that people should definitely explore. And I like it because you have so many people and leaders invited from all different angles. And I remember that when she was saying the role of, whether it's a role of governments, of companies, and I don't know if she mentioned it, but I think of people, you know, in general, to create this dignity across, you know, what we do, what we work on, the supply chains and the world as a whole. And I know that we are recording this as, you know, the world is going through all sorts of new events, and I don't, the purpose didn't want to touch on anything in particular, but it's definitely something to take away, if anything, very, very relevant to what's happening these last weeks, you know, just dignity. That, and I would just add, if you don't mind, the fact that, you know, as humans, you know, I relate dignity to appreciating ourselves for just being us and being humans, you know, not for, you know, who we are, what we do, you know, what jobs, what titles, what material things. And that is something that, and unfortunately, I think maybe in some of the parts of the world that we live in, and the way that the world has been evolving, is something that seems to be pushing anything, everyone to do anything to try to live by that rather than, you know, to help each other to have a better world.
Yeah. I'm on that note, if you don't mind, if I plug, so the next episode that I'm working on, which will be out next month, is with, her name is Sharon Burrow. She's the Secretary General of the ITUC, the International Trade Union Confederation. So the world's largest sort of confederation of unions representing, well, more than 200 million workers globally. And so the idea is sort of how can we kind of explore, you know, in the midst of the pandemic, what needs to happen for us to sort of produce a fair society when it comes to workers, you know, labor rights.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And the last two questions I was going to ask you, you know, given that you do know so many, you know, incredible, inspiring leaders, is what is a leader, you know, to you, or perhaps more specifically, what I call an impact leader, which is the name of the podcast. And then after that is basically any final call to action that you want to ask to our listeners.
I don't have a great answer for you in the sense, I guess what I've been most impressed about, particularly, you know, speaking to people, I don't know, I'm kind of curious what your thoughts are as well, speaking to people in the podcast, but, you know, I'm incredibly impressed when I meet with people who sort of personalize, you know, the experience and why, what within their arc, why it's come to this for them and why are they making this call and why are they this passionate? You know, one of the, I think, most interesting, unexpected interviews that I've ever had was with the CEO of Banco Sabadell Asset Management in Barcelona. And His name is Thetis. But, you know, I sort of came in, and SPAN doesn't have a very strong, or it's historically has never had a strong reputation in terms of responsible investment and ESG. I think that has certainly changed over the last 12 to 18 months, very, very quickly. And there are a lot of smart people, but historically they haven't had that for a number, I think, of reasons. But so I came in, and I guess my expectations were not very high. But he was, you know, when I was talking about sort of his interest in, and Banco Sabadell's sort of interest in ESG, I'd asked, you know, I'd noted that he was quite excitable when it came to, you know, environmental issues. And, you know, I'd asked him, so to explain that, you know, what made him so passionate about this? And he looked at me dumbly because, you know, I should have known the answer, but he looked at me dumbly and he said, because we're Barcelona. Tourism is 25, 30% of the economy. And we are 6 to 10 feet above of sea level. We will be one of the first victims of climate change. And just right there, I mean, you could tell that, I mean, this sort of permeated, you know, everything he was thinking. It was, you know, sort of survival against sort of this abstract notion of climate risk, you know, in the most personal way as a person and as an institution. But it's those kinds of anecdotes that I just find absolutely fascinating and revealing and instructive, particularly to the younger generation.
Oh, brilliant. I think I was just going to say that every answer is the right answer, you know, and I think that, you know, just the way you explain it, I always like to ask the question because there's so many angles to look at. And if I can add, you know, from the incredible leaders I talked to as well, there's so many great definitions that people talk about, but something that comes around, and I just quickly wrote some points on that, is I think it's there are people of action, you know, people, you mentioned abstract and personal at the end, you know, these, you know, people kind of, on the last episode, there was this phrase which I like, which is, you know, they walk the talk. So, you know, they talk about something, they believe in something, but they're doing something about it. And in one of the episodes, I remember, which these are all kind of my values as well, there's something strong about working with others, you know, great leaders, you know, truly realize, you know, that they can inspire others and, you know, bring people together to these, you know, bigger causes. And they have, I don't know if that influence that you know, helps people have a purpose to deliver on, you know, this bigger plan. And lastly, I do talk about this sometimes in episodes. I didn't ask you, but I have had, you know, I personally believe that faith also plays a role, either, you know, from a Christian side or a spiritual side, but even if you're not a believer, you know, leaders have this firm belief, you know, in themselves, in what they're doing, in the people they're working with. So, you know, that becomes, again, I think, personal abstract again, which I think is very important. William, thank you for that. And any last call to action to the listeners, you know, that you asked them to do?
Yeah, you know, I would say stay curious, which I mean that seriously. And in the broadest context, one of the lessons that I've learned, because I do always ask advice from my own guests at the very end, and unequivocally, you know, sort of the message that if you're interested in this space, whether it's on the policy side or the investment side, the NGO side, you name it, or the corporate side, or journalistic side or academic side, you know, take a broad approach, focus on data. Data is one of the, you know, biggest outstanding issues, but it's no substitute for engagement, for the softer side of ESG, for the human side and the natural side of what we're doing. And so I think there's a really compelling argument for why you need to stay involved, you need to ask questions and not be afraid, because the stakes, frankly, are just way too, they're too high enough not to do that.
Thank you so much, Jason. It has been a real pleasure. If people want to get in touch with you, is it better through LinkedIn or any other way?
Yeah, please do. I mean, particularly students, or, you know, you're free to email me at jason.mitchell@man.com. I'm on LinkedIn as well as Twitter. But yeah, I'm always interested in what people think. So feel free.
Fantastic.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on this. Yeah, I really appreciate it.
Okay. It is bye for now, and until our next episode of Impact Leaders, and God bless you all. Please remember to check our sponsors' websites for upcoming events. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Impact Leaders. Impact Leaders is brought to you by ILM Partners and Fast Forward 2030. Please connect with us at ILM Partners for advice on how to transition into sustainable and impact investing. And go to fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goal.